Hi, I'm Luke Dennis, the Development Director at WYSO. We are happy we can deliver these programs to you, people who listen on the web, and we rely on you to help us pay for this service. So at our website, wyso.org, click Support This Station and help keep these services coming. And thank you.
Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and today I'd like to welcome Will Hilton. He's just published his first book. It's called Vanished, The 60-Year Search for the Missing Men of World War II. Welcome to the program, Will.
Thank you.
Will, this is quite a book, and I'm guessing that if you hadn't written it now, you probably couldn't have written it because a lot of your sources would have been gone. In fact, they're probably gone now.
Yeah, you know, one of the challenges of writing about World War II is that so many of the guys who fought and experienced the conditions and the very sort of specific details that you want to be able to recapture on the page are no longer with us. And many of those who remain are losing their memories and their clarity. And so, you know, that was one of the big challenges with reporting this, was trying to find surviving members who could bring me sort of vividly back into the war so that that part of the story would have some life on the page.
Tell our listeners how you came upon this story and decided to write about it.
Well, so Vanished is really the story of one air crew, 11 men, on a B-24 bomber that went down in the Central Pacific Islands of Palau, and then for the next 60 years, searchers from the military and from without the military, sort of volunteer archaeologists and enthusiasts and scientists and scuba divers, all tried to find this particular plane, because the conditions in which it went down and the mystery of where it landed and how many of the men survived and what became of them were haunting to anyone who heard the story. And so years and years and hundreds of thousands of dollars and tens of thousands of man hours later, we're beginning now to understand exactly what happened. But it took a lot of piecing together, and I came onto the story sort of in the midst of some of the new revelations. It was 2008, and I was embedded with a military unit that recovers the remains of missing service members from all over the world who've died in the last 100 years of battle, so since World War I. And the plan initially was for me to travel to a variety of their sites to get a sort of a spectrum of how they work. This would include some of the work they do in the Himalaya Mountains. There's a team there now. Some of the work they do in Southeast Asia related to losses from the Vietnam conflict. And then the first site was going to be this barge in the Pacific Ocean. But when I got onto that barge and I saw all of these elite service members from all the different military services, including Navy divers and Air Force historians and Marine captain and Army captain, all sort of working together to send teams of divers in big helmets down to the bottom of the ocean and come up with debris, I realized that I really just wanted to know what that project was about, what was down there. You know, how many men did they hope to find? Were they just the skeletal remains of those men, or were they on a ship or a plane? And all these sort of questions started swirling in my mind, and I decided to stay focused on it until I got answers. And it was through that process that I discovered how elusive the answers had been. And then we were still a couple years out from some of the answers that make up the end of the book. So I got to sort of report it as the answers were finally coming.
Was this organization JPAC?
It is, yes. The Joint POW-MIA Accounting Command in Hawaii. does all the field work for recovery operations. They're one of just eight in the military that have some responsibility for this work, but they're by far the sort of dominant force because they're the ones who actually deploy to these obscure places for these long missions to try to excavate and exhume whatever skeletal remains still reside on the wreckage of planes and ships.
You discovered that this is really a story about one particular man's obsession, isn't it?
It really is. And I didn't see that coming. Even when I had settled on the idea that I was going to describe this one military mission, I saw it as a group effort. I saw it as fundamentally being about this recovery program the military does. And I was preparing to leave the islands and go home from the barge and write that story when the lead archaeologist for the military unit approached me and said very, very quietly, "You can't do this story until you interview Pat Scannon." And he said, "I know you don't know who that is, but when you get home, you need to find out." So this is a dream for any reporter, right, to have a secret name whispered to you. And I started to look into who this might be when I got home, and I quickly discovered that Pat Scannon is this scientist out in California who has spent, at that time, 15 years, now 20, returning to the islands every year to search for the missing airplanes of the campaign against Japan. And he had found the pieces of this one airplane where the military was doing the operation. And so I flew out to California, and I started to interview Scannon about his work on the islands. And I discovered that this was an obsession bar none. I mean, he had taken this particular plane so closely into his heart and into his life that he was spending late nights every night, seven days a week, researching what might have happened to it and finding all of these conundra and all of these mixed wires in the way that it had been reported in military documents and the way that it had been described to family members, and all of those differed from what witnesses to the crash described. And so, you know, he was trying to convey to me all of this information to fit into this piece of journalism that I was trying to put together, and there was just no time to get it all in there. So the process of trying to write an article about it was enormously unsatisfying. And after I submitted the article and published it in GQ magazine, I found myself just continuing to call Scannon and others and try to figure out more about how this had unfolded. And as I mentioned at the beginning, there were still a lot of mysteries that they were trying to close up. And so I entered into that process with them of trying to track down pieces of data and try to make conflicting accounts reconcile. And at a certain point, I realized that I was already writing a book in my mind and had kind of joined Scannon in his obsession and needed to see it the rest of the way through.
Will Hilton joins us. His book is Vanished, The 60-Year Search for the Missing Men of World War II. I think we forget that this particular war really created a lot of missing in action situations, particularly in the Pacific. I'm fascinated with this entire conflict for one reason. My dad was in the 2nd Marine Division that invaded Saipan, and we learn reading your book that this was a big surprise to the Japanese, that Tojo thought they were coming through Palau.
Yeah. Yeah, he had built up the Palau garrison in the early part of 1944 with the idea that it would be the next big target for the American advance. And so the landing on Saipan really shocked the Japanese command in a massive way. I mean, it led directly to Tojo's resignation because he had personally summoned this commander, Sadai Inoue, to take his troops from Manchuria all the way out to the Palau Islands and prepare for this massive advance that they were expecting.
Let's talk about these big clunky planes. I had no idea what big clunkers these were.
Yeah, the B-24 didn't have much to recommend it. If it was hit by anti-aircraft fire, of which there was a great deal, it tended to lose a wing and catch on fire and go down. It wasn't pressurized, so the guys were experiencing thin air when they were at high altitude and getting dehydrated the whole way. But it had this one great feature, which was that the shape of the wing, the Davis wing, allowed it to fly higher and farther than any other airplane in the fleet at that point in the war. This was before the B-29 became a big part of the air fleet. And at that time, the B-24 was the only heavy bomber that could cross the distance between a lot of these islands. So when we're talking about, you know, Saipan and the Marianas, we needed Saipan to hit Tokyo, but we needed another island chain, the Marshalls, in order to get to Saipan. And we needed Tarawa, which I've also written about, in order to get to the Marshalls. So when you're making these long flights, you needed to have a plane that could do it. And you need, even if it was a bad sort of a bad plane that none of the air crews really liked to fly and had all of these horrible challenges associated with it, it was the only plane that could do it. So when you talk to the surviving airmen who flew on these B-24s, they have a real love-hate relationship with it. You know, it kept them alive, and it got the job done, and it allowed them to win the war. But it was a pretty tough spot to be in, to be over hostile skies, you know, and taking anti-aircraft fire and knowing that the plane was just really not very well defended. So, some of the air commanders in the U.S. forces were not at all happy to have these planes in their fleet. They much preferred the B-17, which was more stable all around.
Well, you do a splendid job of introducing us to these missing crew members. You went back and apparently found a lot of letters and talked to surviving family members, and this strikes me as probably one of the most difficult parts of the job.
Yeah, it was the most difficult, and it was, for me, internally the most important. I felt that it was really essential to try to bring these guys, these 11 guys, back to life on the page. Because what I found, as I got to know not only Pat Scannon better, but the families who were waiting for Pat Scannon to do his work and find the planes, and waiting for the teams like the one on the barge to come home with answers, those families do not see these losses so much as being something from the past. They're traumas that linger today in their families, that there's an empty place at the dinner table. And you often hear stories from families who have someone missing about how the family as a unit has never been the same since. And so I thought it was really important to convey why this work means so much to the people who receive it, to the people who have waited 70 years for answers, who have wondered, and, you know, who, even if they didn't know the missing person, know what great harm was brought upon their family by this unexplained disappearance, by the lack of closure, of never having a body to bury, or an ending to the story of what happened to this person who meant so much to a mother or a grandmother or even in some cases a great aunt. And so you find all of these MIA relatives who are in their 20s or 30s and have no personal connection to the missing person, but understand that loss and understand the importance it has played in their life and in the life of their family. And in order to sort of capture that and understand that, I wanted to help the reader feel the presence of these men so that when they vanished, that loss would be felt by the reader as well.
And, well, when you describe how they finally found this missing plane and where it was and what it looked like, I know the waters around Palau are probably pretty warm, but it still gave me chills.
Yeah. You know, the story that I'll never forget was told to me by a guy named Tommy Doyle, who's a football coach out in West Texas. And he, his father, Jimmy, was a gunner on this plane. And when Tommy heard that parts of the plane had been found, he didn't know whether his dad was going to be on it. I mean, everybody knew that that some parachutes had been seen in the sky and some of the crewmen had gotten off, and each family sustained some hope that perhaps their relative was among those who escaped. And Tommy's family, even in a heightened way, believed that his father had survived. And there were stories within his family from his uncle suggesting that his father was living in California and had a wife and two daughters, and had decided to use this opportunity to leave behind a life in West Texas that he no longer wanted to pursue. And so Tommy spent his whole life not knowing whether that could really be true or not. You know, there are cases where things like that did happen. He didn't know if it was true in his case. And so he went out, he decided to go out to Palau and see this plane. And he took scuba diving classes in this muddy lake in Texas, and his first blue water dive was out in Palau. And he swam down to the tail section of the plane, and he told me he got down there, and he was suddenly overwhelmed by the feeling that his dad was there. He didn't have proof of it, and he didn't know what proof might come, but he held on to the plane, and he had a conversation with his dad for the first time in his life.
Wow. There are so many mysteries, and this really reads like a detective story. And when we hear about how aerial photography was so crucial in putting some of this together, and also the eyewitness testimony of people on the island who actually saw these planes coming down. Like, one guy was in a cave.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? When you travel across the Pacific Islands, almost everywhere you go, you encounter local people who feel so strongly about these aviators and airmen who flew the air campaign against Japan and, as far as they're concerned, liberated their islands from a very, very brutal colonial oppressor. So I just got back from a trip to Kiribati, where some recovery work is underway on Bessio Island in the Tarawa Atoll. This is an incredibly bloody battle by the 2nd Marines. And so, you know, before they got to Saipan, for three days, they took this incredible, incredibly well-defended Japanese island, and they fought and died in huge numbers. By the time it was over, on this half a square mile, there were more than 1,000 Americans dead. And today, the Kiribati people are intimately involved in the recovery effort to locate those men in the shallow, sandy soil and help get them home for burial, because it meant as much to them that we were there as it meant to us. It was as important to them, if not more so, to push back the Japanese advance, because their islands were being overswept by Japanese colonial interests, in some cases beginning in the 20s. In the case of Kiribati, just 2 days after Pearl Harbor, the Japanese came in and took the island and expelled most of the natives. And so the locals there really, really feel a close affinity to our guys. And on Palau, you know, they came forward to recall the planes they saw going down during firefights, and they were enormously helpful in pinpointing where the wreckage might be.
Will Hilton joins us on the program today. His book is Vanished: The 60-Year Search for the Missing Men of World War II. My dad was still in San Diego when they invaded Tarawa and learned that terrible lesson about crossfire. And that really helped them with the Saipan invasion and ongoing invasions. They learned a terrible lesson that day.
Yeah.
I'm looking at your bio here, Will, and I see where it says, you have scaled the world's tallest active volcano, crawled inside a nuclear reactor, and bicycled 1,000 miles across rural Cuba. Now, that's the one I want to hear about.
In 1999, I made the questionable decision to fly down to Havana with a bicycle and a friend. And we went west from there out to the peninsula of Guanahasabibes and there's a military base there, a Cuban military base. And we convinced them to let us go out to the very, very tip of the peninsula so that we could eventually say we had cycled all the way across the island. The route we took ended up being 1,100 miles. Those first few miles were maybe the worst because we were cycling on the beach, which doesn't work out too well when you have skinny road tires.
Uh-huh.
And about halfway across, we ended up getting robbed and had all of our money stolen, so we had to go back to Havana and basically beg on the streets for about a week while we tried to contact the U.S. officials who hang out at the Swiss embassy. We had to also convince our contacts in Cuba to get word to the Cuban guards who surround the Swiss embassy precisely because they know Americans are in there.
Yeah.
So we eventually got both sides to agree to let us pass through, first through the Cuban barricade around the Swiss embassy, and then into the American interest section of the Swiss embassy where the folks there, the Americans there, who said they worked for the State Department, although who knows, peeled off rolls of $100 bills to us in one of the more peculiar experiences I've ever had. And it gave us new passports so that we could continue on our harebrained scheme to bicycle across Cuba, which we finally did. And judging from the experience we had out on the western tip of the island with the looks of confusion among the military leaders there, my guess is we're the only ones who had ever done it and maybe still ever have.
It sounds like it actually was wonderful.
It was. So many people go to Cuba and form their opinions based on what they see in Havana or Santiago or the big cities, where you see all the old cars and, there's the great music and sometimes good food, increasingly so, I think. But what we saw was the countryside, and Cuba's huge. I mean, it's about the same size as all of the other Caribbean islands put together. So, the fact that it took us 1,100 miles to get across, it gives you a sense of how much variety you might see. I mean, there's a desert out there near the town of Emias, which is not too far from Guantanamo. There are mountains around Bayamo. Pico Turquino is the highest point. I think it's about 6,500 feet. So the distance from where you start climbing to where you reach the top is not so different from the amount of climbing you have to do to summit Pikes Peak. I mean, it's a great deal of climbing. And everything in between. I mean, you have the plains of central Cuba. You obviously have the beaches. So we just saw all of these wonderful different parts of the country that not too many people see. And we just stayed in people's houses. We'd get into a town and knock on doors and ask if anyone knew anyone who might be willing to help us and give us a place to stay and something to eat.
Would you peel off a $100 bill when you were doing it?
Yeah. We tried to, whenever we found a hotel, we'd try to change them down to lower denominations so we didn't have to overpay quite that much.
Uh-huh. Wow. You're making me jealous.
That's fun.
Will Hilton joins us. His book is Vanished, The 60-Year Search for the Missing Men of World War II. I think one of the more interesting aspects of this whole story is how you had all these deep sea divers, and yet a very key element in all this was skydivers.
Yeah. So Pat Scanlon, couldn't have done all of this by himself. He couldn't have found these planes and handed that information to the military all by himself. When he would get down underwater to scan the seafloor and do these sort of methodical grid searches, one quadrant at a time, to see if there was any evidence of wreckage. You kind of can't do that by yourself. You need other people. The same way you would canvas the woods in search of a missing child or something, you sort of fan out and you cross the ground together in the hopes that, everyone's eyes will be sort of referencing what's in front of each other as well as what's in front of themselves. And, it was just by the sort of force of goodwill that others had decided over the years to join Scanlon. I mean, he started out trying to do it alone, often without much success. He would get out in the jungle and get lost, or he would get underwater and get confused in the milky sediment that sometimes washes out of the mangroves. And if you ever experienced that, it's pretty scary stuff. And what happened was, as he continued to do it, people he knew would mention it to people they knew, and the word sort of spread around Central California where he lives. and then further around the country from there, until he started to get calls sort of randomly and sporadically from people who would say, I'm willing to spend 2 weeks and pay my way to fly to the far side of the world and muck around in the jungle. Would you like some help? And eventually this community, mostly made up of skydivers, formed around him and gave themselves the name Bent Prop, the Bent Prop Project, which stands for Bent Propeller. And it was partly because so many of them had done aerial formations together and cooperated. Some of the people on his team had, for example, set skydiving records for the greatest number of people in the sky at once. And so it was from that experience that they had in the sky that they were able to conduct these sort of very methodical and, in fact, scientific approaches to searching in the jungle or underwater. They knew how to coordinate together. They were prepared to do physically exhausting things. And some of them also came from a military background. You find that a fair number of skydivers took their first dive on a military aircraft while in the service. So they also had this sort of emotional connection to the issue of MIAs. And today that's still true. The Bent Prop Project is still out there. They go every year for several weeks to the Palau Islands. Many, many of the team members are skydivers, and they still fan out across the seafloor in search of missing airplanes.
Wow. Well, this is quite a story. It's Vanished, the 60-year search for the missing men of World War II. Will Hilton wrote it, and when you read it, you'll discover one of the greatest unsolved mysteries in this whole story is the guy who was flying the plane that day and what that's all about. But you'll need to read the book to find out about that. I'm not doing any spoilers here. And we really appreciate your time, Will.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Are you working on another book?
Not yet, but okay. I am starting to think about it.
Okay. Good response so far to this one?
It has been, yeah. It's been very interesting to have conversations like this one, because for so long, trying to piece this narrative together has been a sort of a solitary experience, you know. And it's nice to finally have a book out that I can show to people and then talk about with people, rather than just kind of trying to process what this story is in the pain cave of my office for a blank page.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. Our guest has been Will S. Hilton. His book, Vanished, the 60-Year Search for the Missing Men of World War II. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. The ranks of crime fiction writers are filled with former crime beat reporters like John Sanford and Michael Connelly, and a lot of former law enforcement officers. Archer Mayer kind of went at it backwards. He was writing crime fiction in his native state of Vermont, and the police were so impressed with his writing that they said, "Why don't you become a police officer?" So he did. Archer Mayer has just written his 25th crime fiction novel in a series about some investigators in Vermont. It's called Three Can Keep a Secret. We'll be talking to Archer Mayer next week in the Book Nook. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.